The court calls United States v. Simmacher. Counsel for the appellate, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Ryan Aiken, and I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Alyssa Simmacher.
Can you hear in the back? That's a no, so you want to do something with that. Okay.
Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I can't hear in the front either.
Can you hear on the side? Okay. All right. The court calls United States v. Simmacher. Counsel for the appellant. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Ryan Aiken. I represent the appellant, Petty Officer Alyssa Simmacher. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Petty Officer Simmacher was denied the right to a fair trial when the government failed to preserve essential evidence. Rule for Court Martial 703 F2 specifically addresses lost and destroyed evidence and requires the military judge to abate the proceedings when three factors are met. First, when the lost evidence is of such central importance as to be essential to a fair trial. Second, when there is no adequate substitute for the lost evidence. And third, when the loss of the evidence could not have been prevented by the requesting party. In this case, all three factors are met, and therefore the military judge erred when he failed to suppress the lab report or abate the proceedings. I'd like to begin by talking about the first factor under RCM 702, whether the evidence was essential to a fair trial.
What standard are we reviewing this under? Is this plain error? I noticed that you didn't ask for abatement at the trial level.
Correct, Your Honor. Because the military, or the defense requested suppression of the lab report, this court reviews that ruling for an abuse of discretion.
But you're asking now for abatement. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. In this particular case, suppression of the lab report would have essentially amounted to the same thing because the lab report was the entirety of the government's case on this charge.
Are you arguing that abatement is the only lawful relief?
Yes, Your Honor.
So other relief is not an option. If you're right on everything, the only alternative is abatement?
Yes, Your Honor.
What if there was an adequate substitute, for example?
Well, if there was an adequate substitute for the evidence, then it would not meet the RCM 703 standard.
What about the language in the rule that talks about other relief, which I'll find somewhere here? Where does it say it shall be abatement alone?
The rule says,
which is different than saying something else, but go ahead.
Okay. If the rule says, if such evidence is of such central importance as to be essential to a fair trial, and there is no adequate substitute for such evidence, the military judge shall grant a continuance or other relief in order to attempt to produce the evidence. So that's option one. He has discretion to craft some remedy in order to produce the essential evidence. But by definition, if the evidence is essential to a fair trial and it cannot be produced, then there is no other option when the rule says as much, or the military judge shall abate the proceedings. So by plain reading of the rule, if all three factors are met, then there is no discretion to craft any remedy other than abatement of the proceedings.
Who had the burden to show that it was essential?
The defense would have had the burden, I think, to prove that it was essential at trial.
Adequate substitute, does it have to be in a particular form, or can an adequate substitute be an instruction, for example?
Well, there's very little guidance on what RCM 703 would allow for an adequate substitute. I think
It's hard to come up with a substitute for a bottle of urine.
Yes, Your Honor.
Some other bottle of urine, I suppose, but are you arguing that there is the only adequate substitute is a like substitute, or could a curative instruction be an adequate substitute, provided it is an adequate substitute? Under SEPA, for example, you put the defendant in a position that they would be a comparable position to what they would have been in had they been able to introduce the evidence. You see what I'm saying? So they don't say you have to either use that evidence or nothing. You have to put the person in the same position. So one could say an adequate substitute is something that would put the person in the same position, blah, blah, blah.
Correct, Your Honor. But in this case, where the evidence, the whole case was based on What was the contents of a urine sample on a particular date at a particular time? And there's simply no way to replicate that. And an adverse inference instruction that allows the members to infer...
Well, don't go there yet. Just first, so in theory, are you conceding that in theory an instruction could be adequate as an adequate substitute? What if the instruction were to say you can't consider the lab report? Are you going to say that's not an adequate substitute?
I would say... I would equate that to a remedy question. Rather than abatement, providing an instruction would be a form of remedy. An instruction which said that you are required to disregard the lab report would be adequate in this case.
So it could be an adequate substitute. First, the abstract principle of law, which is an instruction could be an adequate substitute before getting to...
Yes, Your Honor. In some circumstances, an instruction could be an adequate substitute, but it wouldn't in this particular case.
No, I understand that.
Now, are you saying it couldn't in this particular case, or that the instruction that was given by the judge in this case didn't meet the standard?
The instruction given by the military judge in this case was not an adequate remedy.
So you weren't just saying that the military judge in this case could not have given a curative instruction that would have been satisfactory?
Correct.
Because you got to have the P.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Why do you have to have the P instead of the lab report?
Because the lab report, there's inherent limits to what the lab report can show. The lab report itself is conclusory in nature. The appellant does not contend that the lab report does not show a positive urinalysis sample. The issue is that there could have been errors along the way that we would have no way of knowing about. Both the
is it something unique to this case, or would it appear in any urinalysis case?
Theoretically, it would appear in any urinalysis case.
So it's not the label issue, insofar as there may be a label issue.
No, not specifically. That's certainly a factor that the court could consider in determining whether or not the lab report...
But fundamentally what you're saying is that the liquid is essential evidence in any naked urinalysis
case. In any naked urinalysis case, okay. Yes, Your Honor. When there is no other evidence of cocaine use,
right,
then the lab report is pretty much the entirety of the case. There is no substitute for the defense's ability to examine the urine sample itself.
And your case is based on the fact that a second test would prove that the first test was erroneous.
It could, Your Honor.
It would have to for you to prevail, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, when we're talking about the label based on Judge Stuckey's question, from your reading of the record, who was responsible for the placing of the label in a manner that resulted in the barcode reading system not working?
I believe it would be a laboratory technician. I don't know that I have the facts.
So it wasn't at the unit, and it wasn't the appellant after providing the sample who affixed the label. It was
at the lab.
Certainly
would not have been the appellant who would have affixed the label. Whenever a urine sample is given, there's the urinalysis program coordinator who is there collecting the samples and affixes the label to the bottle. However, once the sample arrives at the laboratory, it then gets transferred to different receptacles for different phases of processing, I believe. So it certainly would not have been the appellant who affixed the label, but I can't say for sure who specifically in the process would have affixed the label.
So under any scenario, it was a government actor who affixed the label.
The starting point for this court's analysis under RCM 703 should be its opinion in the United States v. Manuel. In that case, this court held that the urine sample itself was essential to a fair trial when the urinalysis report was the primary evidence of drug use. In support of that holding, the court found that there was a genuine controversy as to the urinalysis result due to the relatively low nanogram level of the metabolite. That factor is again present in this case. The nanogram level in this case was significantly lower than it was in Manuel, and it was closer to the DOD cutoff. Other facts of significance to the court were the fact that appellant denied having used cocaine, and the appellant expressed a sincere desire for an independent retest. And again, those factors are present in this case. When she was first confronted with the urinalysis result by NCIS agents, Petty Officer Simmermacher immediately denied having used cocaine. She requested to submit to another urinalysis test, which came back negative, and she requested to submit to a polygraph test, which was not administered. The only basis for distinction between this case and Manuel is when the government negligence occurred. In Manuel, the negligence occurred at the drug screening lab, and the negligence was that they failed to preserve the sample for the mandatory one-year retention period. In this case, the negligence happened at the command level in failing to request that the sample be preserved after that one-year retention period had expired. But the court also found in Manuel that that retention period exists to protect the statutory right of each service member's access to evidence. And that right cannot simply disappear simply because the one-year retention period has expired. Rather, that one-year period is when, again, the responsibility for preservation of the sample transfers to the command. And the reason that there's a one-year retention period is presumably because that's enough time for the command to determine whether or not they're going to bring charges or to submit a request to have the sample preserved at trial.
Counsel, in your view, what should we make of the bad faith argument by the government?
Well, this court again held in U.S. v. Manuel that bad faith is not a part of the 703F2 analysis. There is no bad faith requirement on the face of the rule. And again, in Manuel, the court went through the constitutional due process analysis for lost evidence and the Article 46 UCMJ analysis, and they addressed the issue of bad faith, and they found that there was no bad faith in Manuel, and yet they still found that the appellate was entitled to relief due to the negligence of the government and the fact that the sample itself was essential to a fair trial.
Counsel, in your view, is 703 completely untethered from the Supreme Court's case law in Youngblood and cases along those same lines?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Well, they're addressing fundamentally different issues, and they have different concerns. The Supreme Court's decisions in Trombetta and Youngblood, their concern there was, what is the bare minimum protection that the Due Process Clause of the Constitution requires of law enforcement and investigatory personnel to preserve samples that they have no obligation otherwise to preserve? And they're trying to craft a rule that is widely applicable in a wide variety of cases. And the bad faith requirement and the exculpatory nature of the evidence they thought were workable rules that could work in a variety of cases. However, in this case, the President has specifically addressed lost evidence with the 703 rule that was not available to the Supreme Court. And there is no bad faith requirement written into the rule.
But how are we to interpret the language, such evidence is of such central importance to an issue that is essential to a fair trial? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, it's a fact-based question, I'd say, Your Honor.
Does it mean the urine in any urinalysis case?
Any urine sample in any urinalysis case where there is no other evidence of cocaine use, and again, there's a relatively low metabolite level of cocaine metabolite in the sample. The appellant has denied having used cocaine, expressed sincere desire. These are all facts that the court should consider in determining whether or not, in the particular facts and circumstances of this case, the urine sample was of central importance. In other cases, there may be testimony of other witnesses who had seen the appellant use cocaine or may find cocaine. But when there's nothing else for the appellant to use to prepare a defense, there is no replacement. She's left without any defense, without the ability to conduct her own observations of the sample itself.
Counsel, is your better argument that retesting of the sample would have shown that the amount of cocaine metabolite didn't reach the DOD levels? Or is your better argument that this urine in that particular cup was not appellant's urine?
Neither of those are possibilities. There's the possibility that there was some contamination of the sample, there was some misreading of the sample in the process, or that the sample had been confused. Any of those have been confused with another sample. Any of those possibilities could account for the cocaine metabolite in the sample that was on the lab report that was admitted to trial.
In your argument, are you asking us to plow any new ground here, expand the borders of Manuel?
No, Your Honor. This case really falls squarely under Manuel. There was no violation of a regulation. Again, that's the only substantive distinction between this case and Manuel. But for that fact, this case is identical to Manuel. But again, as I would point to this court's language in United States v. Madigan, in that case, the court rejected the government's argument that the urine sample was essential to a fair trial simply because the third factor of the RCM 703 analysis had not been met. The court found that the appellant could have prevented the destruction of the sample because defense counsel was assigned to the case for a two-year period while the sample was being held in the lab. It wasn't until after it had been destroyed that a request was submitted. The court held specifically that the responsibility for the unavailability of the evidence rests with the party that failed to make the request and could have prevented the destruction of the sample. In that case, that responsibility clearly falls with the government. The appellant had no ability to request the sample be preserved because by the time the defense counsel was assigned, the sample had already been destroyed.
And in your view, what should this court make of the ex-boyfriend's testimony?
The court should give very little weight to that testimony for the purposes of the analysis here, because it was admitted for the purpose of consciousness of guilt, but it only tends to show consciousness of guilt if, in fact, there was reason to believe that Petty Officer Siremacher, in fact, was asking him to say something that she herself did not believe. And the statements that she made could easily be interpreted as an honest attempt to explain how it is she could possibly have tested positive for cocaine, or her frustration at the fact that she was facing a urine analysis report that she had no ability to reply. There are no further questions, Your Honor. I'd like to conclude my argument.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government, please. Sorry.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Captain Corey Carvin, along with Mr. Brian Keller, on behalf of the United States. The military judge here did not abuse his discretion for two reasons. First, the language fair trial in RCM 703F2 has not been defined by this court within this context and should be defined by whether or not the United States acted in bad faith or whether they didn't act in accord with their normal practices. And second, regardless, an adequate remedy was provided by the military judge here within his discretion. So first, the court has not addressed the language fair trial, but the language has been defined by the U.S. Supreme Court within this same context, the context of destroyed evidence. A fair trial should require the appellant to make a showing of either, one, the United States acted in bad faith in destroying the evidence, or two, that the destruction of the evidence was not in accord with normal practices.
There's a certain logic issue with that, though, which is even if the government doesn't act in bad faith, you still want a fair trial, don't you?
Correct, Your Honor, and that brings into the second point, which is...
I mean, if there's no evidence, you can't have a fair trial, even if everybody acted in good faith.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence that was presented at trial to convict the appellant was the litigation packet, as well as the evidence presented through the testifying witnesses that appellant had an opportunity to cross-examine.
I'm probing the connection between why a fair trial equals the presence or absence of good faith, bad faith.
Well, Your Honor, that was the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of fundamental fairness. Well,
but that's after they find that a predicate isn't met, right? Which is that the evidence that's missing isn't material exculpatory evidence. I mean, if it's material important evidence and it's missing, then you don't get to the other things.
Correct, Your Honor. We are dealing with exculpatory evidence.
It would take us out of the realm of
bad faith, good faith. That's correct. Here, there's no exculpatory evidence. In fact, the CCA, the appellant argued at the CCA that there was constitutional violation of due process as well as a violation of the RCM 703F2. What's before this court is the violation of the 703F2, not the constitutional due process. Exculpatory evidence could be found within the central importance language of RCM 703F2, but this evidence here was not exculpatory as defined by the U.S. Supreme Court under the constitutional due process.
Well, if the issue isn't constitutional due process, why do you spend so much time on it in your brief?
Your Honor, simply to address the language fair trial in 703F2.
But you're trying to get exculpatory from Youngblood and bring it into 703. Where's the word exculpatory appear in 703?
No, Your Honor, exculpatory not coming into 703F2, although exculpatory evidence would be considered centrally important. There would be other evidence that would possibly be contained within that central importance as well.
Yeah, it's a urinalysis, urine.
But correct, Your Honor. So the central importance, whether that's centrally important, would be an analysis that this court would have to undertake.
One would think, okay, in a naked urinalysis case, that urine was centrally important, wouldn't one?
Yes, Your Honor, but the argument then comes to the term fair trial and what that means and how it's defined by the Supreme
Court. Well, and you're now asking us to import bad faith into that, something we declined to do in Manuel. Why should we do it?
Well, Your Honor, because it hasn't been defined, the fair trial analysis, but it has been defined, we're asking that this court adopt the definition that the U.S. Supreme Court has adopted as to fair trial.
Well, but we have a rule that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't have. We have 703.
Correct, Your Honor.
Supreme Court analysis, as I understand it, didn't include that. So why should we import bad faith on the strength of Supreme Court analysis?
Well, Your Honor, the proposed definition of fair trial that the government is making will clarify the perceived inconsistencies between the case law, the precedent in this court, between Kern, Manuel,
you mean,
and Ellis.
What you're really arguing is it would be a good thing.
Yes, Your Honor, it would be a good thing, and it would clarify those inconsistencies.
And then what the government should do is they should test all the urine, get a positive test, and then have a policy of destroying it instantly, and then just follow its policy in the regular course of business.
Well, Your Honor,
the government would say that's fair, because as long as it's not in bad faith, it's fair.
Well, Your Honor, that actually is the facts of Trombetta, where the Supreme Court has found that there was no bad faith on the part of the government because their policies were exercised in accordance with the normal practices. That in that particular case, there was breathalyzers that were destroyed immediately following the breath samples themselves were immediately destroyed following the breathalyzer examination, and the court found that there was no bad faith on the part of the government. However, if you look at United States v. Madigan, which comes out of this court, it does give these hypotheticals of potentially problematic areas such as the one that Your Honor has stated here, which is, well, what if you have a policy that's so short that the appellant can't request her urine or can't request any type of evidence prior to the destruction of that evidence? This, the government argues that this is a fourth scenario under that same United States v. Madigan, which is what happens when the normal practice is reasonable, meaning the 12 months prior to destruction. However, because
so the problem here, though, is this isn't the normal practice. The command was notified, were they not?
Yes, Your Honor, as well
and,
as the
and
appellant.
The government would. When was the appellant notified?
She was notified of a positive urinalysis.
And so she was supposed to know at that time she should request that they retain it past the normal one-year procedure. Did she receive a letter from the lab saying, please let us know if you'd like us to retain this beyond the ordinary one-year time period?
No, Your Honor. The United States concedes that she didn't have that opportunity until she was obviously given detailed
But the United States government did have that opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor.
And knowing that they thought that she was had used cocaine.
Yes, Your Honor. But the specifics of this particular case, looking at the whether it was bad faith, I know the military judge found that it was negligence on the part of the government and not.
Well, it's more than negligence. Isn't it approaching sharp practice to prefer charges right after the sample goes away?
In many circumstances, yes, Your Honor. Under these circumstances and these facts of this case, no. There were allegations of child abuse that were taking place at the same time.
Right, they severed those.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so you got a naked urinalysis case here. The government piddles around for over a year. The sample is destroyed because the government didn't request it be preserved. And then, poof, we prefer charges.
No, Your Honor.
So what's the accused supposed to do? The accused who wasn't the accused until after the sample was destroyed.
Correct, Your Honor. However, the facts that the child abuse allegations do play a part in why the preferral of charges did take as long as it was.
That's right, but it doesn't play a part in explaining why the government didn't respond to the letter.
Correct.
It's not like, please respond to this letter unless you're also investigating a child abuse case.
Correct, Your Honor, which is the United States concedes that that is negligence. The military judge properly found that that is negligence on the part of the United States. Not bad faith in that particular regard. The child abuse allegations were significant because when she popped, or when there was the positive urinalysis, she was pregnant at the time, and there was investigation into the child abuse based upon those allegations of
the alleged abuse. Child abuse was using drugs while you were pregnant.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was the alleged child abuse using drugs while you were pregnant?
No, Your Honor. It was with her...
Or was it an existing child?
It was her son that she had at the time. But that added to the investigation, and the investigative NCIS was awaiting medical reports, et cetera, to put together and complete their investigation, and that's why preferral of charges took place.
You said that the second prong of your argument is that the judge provided an adequate remedy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you mean an adequate substitute, or do you mean an appropriate remedy? What I'm trying to get at is, are you saying there was an adequate substitute provided, or are you saying, notwithstanding the appellant's argument earlier, that other relief was provided, which was an adequate remedy?
Well, Your Honor, it was both. It was an adequate substitute, which provided the destruction was a remedy to aid that adequate substitute. In this particular...
Do you understand the pivot point here is whether we're having a debate about what the language in the rule says about other relief, or whether we're still up top figuring out whether an adequate substitute was provided?
Well, I can address your first point as far as yeah. adequate substitute first. There was an adequate substitute provided, although there has been a little case law specifically out of this court addressing what that actually means, what adequate substitute means. However, in other contexts...
Wait, what was the adequate substitute in this case?
Your Honor, it was the litigation packet itself as well as the witnesses that testified with no objection from the appellant at trial as to the process... And she
How is that an adequate substitute for an assertion of innocent ingestion or label mixing up? That wasn't my urine. How is that an adequate substitute for that?
Well, Your Honor, she was able to attack the faulty calibration, the misread of the cart, or excuse me, the bottle, the code reader, as well as attack the operator error. If you look at the joint appendix, the certifying laboratory official testified, and on cross-examination, appellant was able to indicate that up to 15 people had touched the sample over 3 days, suggesting operator error, that three machines had tested the sample indicating faulty calibration, that they received thousands of vials, they all looked the same, that she brought up the possibility that there was human error as well, asked that there...
So you're essentially, it sounds like you're arguing that it's not really that there was a substitute, it's that she was able to put on her defense.
Correct, Your Honor, that the evidence that she...
It's not literally a substitute, because that's all stuff she would have been able to do anyway, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
It's not like the judge said, here, and now you get to do X, or here's Y. It's not really a substitute.
Correct. She would have been able to do that regardless of whether the urine sample was destroyed. But the litigation packet itself is substituted for the destroyed urine sample itself would be an adequate substitute.
But if what you wanted to do was retest the urine sample because you thought that the original results were inaccurate, how is the first test that she thinks is inaccurate a substitute for the second test that she wasn't able to do?
Well, Your Honor, again, the only thing that we know about a potential fourth test would be that she was hoping that potentially it would be a sculpatory. However, case law in this particular area, at least, again, it's limited in this particular jurisdiction, but under the Supreme Court constitutional jurisdiction, as far as the due process clause, have found that those have been adequate substitutes. In Trombetta, for example, the breathalyzer sample results, even if they were inaccurate, or might have been exculpatory, The appellant still had alternative means of demonstrating their innocence, and there was multiple appellants in that particular case that they weren't intoxicated while driving. And the court points out that the appellants could have attacked faulty calibration. They had an opportunity to attack the extraneous interference.
You don't disagree that the president has the ability to provide greater protections to service members than the Supreme Court or the Constitution do?
Yes, Your Honor. The United States concedes that.
If we don't import the due process standards into the rule, do you still prevail?
Your Honor, it's not importing the due process. Adequate substitute hasn't been defined by this court.
Well, you're asking us to adopt their definition.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor.
Pretty close to it.
Yes, Your Honor. And under the constitutional due process, it uses language of comparable evidence. Comparable evidence, and here in RCM 703F2 is adequate substitute.
Well, if we don't adopt that definition that we have taken, or you have taken, from the due process standards, do you still prevail?
Yes, Your Honor, because that remedy was provided through the instruction, and we talked about the difference between whether it was a remedy or an adequate substitute. That remedy actually played a part in the substitute by having that adverse inference instruction given to the members that they could hold it against the government or the prosecution.
Well, the instruction is pretty tepid. The instruction says, well, this stuff isn't here, and she doesn't have access to it, and from that you can incur that it would have gone against the government, but you don't have to. So where's that leave it? That doesn't sound like much. How does that, in any case, square this mess?
Well, Your Honor, there is no case where an adverse instruction within the military, specifically on this point, has been used or even noted upon in an opinion. However, in United States v. Youngblood, that same exact instruction was very similar. And Justice Stevens there noted in his concurrence that the uncertainty as to what the evidence might have proved was turned to the defendant's advantage because that instruction gave it the possibility that they could use that against the prosecution. Even though it would have been inculpatory evidence for a retest, or likely would have been inculpatory evidence.
We don't know that.
Correct, Your Honor. However, we do have three tests showing that it was inculpatory.
Okay, I've got to repeat what I think Judge Erdman was asking, and that is, if we adhere to Manuel, do you lose?
Well, Your Honor, Manuel and Dicta does talk about how there should be...
We adhere to the tack we took in Manuel, do you lose?
No, Your Honor, because they destroyed the sample prior to and not in accord with their normal practices.
What difference does that make? Because prong three says that the defense wasn't able to get it preserved, and that's what this case is. Because you were piddling around for a year with child abuse or God knows what else, and the sample got destroyed just because the government destroyed it in accordance with procedure rather than screwed up and destroyed it early. What difference does that make? It's equally unavailable.
Well, Your Honor, in that particular case, the court focused on that the gross negligence was on the part of the drug lab in their handling of the urine sample and their premature destruction.
So is what you're saying that the difference between gross negligence and simple negligence is enough?
No, Your Honor.
Because the judge found negligence here.
Correct, Your Honor. But it was the drug lab that there was a viable argument as to the reliability of the urine sample in Manuel, whereas here we don't have that. There's no evidence.
Well, you got a lower cutoff than you did in Manuel.
Correct, Your Honor. However, in Manuel, again, the gross negligence, the lab technician that testified in Manuel testified that they were grossly negligent in mishandling, mislabeling, and ultimately prematurely destroying the urine sample. We don't have that evidence here. So that might fall under the prong of centrally important, whether the urine sample itself was centrally important, which in this case, again, there was no question as to the reliability of the evidence itself. In fact, appellant's own expert testified that in reviewing the litigation packet that they didn't see any type of processing error or any type of mechanical error, whereas he also testified that if they had retested it a year later, that it may have dropped by 1 or 2 nanograms at the most, which would still be well above the cutoff level.
What are the standards for a retest? What does an accused have to show to get a retest?
Your Honor, if it's government mandated, a retest would be a relevance and a necessary analysis. So it'd have to be relevant and necessary as far as forcing the government to do the test on their own dime. But the appellant could retest that urine sample conceivably whenever the appellant requested it. So there wouldn't be any type of showing if it was the appellant on appellant.
It'd be their right to retest it if they paid for it.
Correct, Your Honor.
How do you interpret or how do you respond to the appellant's argument with respect to the relief? They read the clause, and if there is no adequate substitute for such evidence, the military shall grant a continuance or other relief in order to attempt to produce the evidence or shall abate the proceedings. And the appellant reads that to mean you can give other relief while you're still attempting to produce the evidence, but once you determine that the evidence can't be produced, you're into the shall abate the proceedings portion of the event. How do you interpret this provision? Do you interpret it the same way?
No, Your Honor. In fact, this court hasn't interpreted that way either. Both Manuel and Kern have found that RCM 703F2 gives the court discretion to fashion an appropriate remedy if lost evidence is of such central importance. And that remedy is
because that remedy is other relief or because that remedy is an adequate substitute?
Because the other remedy is an adequate relief, Your Honor. The abatement is not and should not be the only appropriate remedy. In United States v. Ellis, they actually, the court specifically focuses on an adverse inference instruction. In that case, it wasn't given, so that would be dicta in that case. However, they do state that is an appropriate curative measure for improper destruction of evidence, an adverse instruction inference, which is what we have here. The military judge did instruct, did give that adverse inference, and the members ultimately rejected that because of the overwhelming evidence. However, that was properly given, and it was within the military judge's discretion, as this court has found in both the United States v. Manuel as well as United States v. Kern. I see that my time's.
No other questions. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have time for rebuttal. Which you're welcome to or not.
Excuse me. Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to briefly address the issue of adequate remedy. Again, it's appellant's position that there is no, when the evidence is essential to a fair trial and it cannot be replaced, there is no remedy available to the judge other than abatement of proceedings. However, assuming that the court follows what it said in Manuel and says that the military judge does have discretion to craft an appropriate remedy, the instruction that the military judge gave in this case was not an adequate remedy. He said that you may infer that the missing evidence would have been adverse to the prosecution. But in a urinalysis case like this, saying that you may infer that it was adverse is essentially saying that you may infer that it would have come back negative. But if they have no forensic evidence to back up, to support that sort of inference, there's no reason why any reasonable juror could make that, that inference. Especially in light of all the evidence that the government has presented supporting the reliability of this case. Furthermore, the problem is that the instruction essentially contradicts the permissive inference instruction. The judge says that you may infer that the accused wrongfully used drugs based on the presence of the lab report, but you may also infer that the lab report was wrong based on the fact that the sample was missing. And this essentially leaves the members to make a decision based on no evidence whatsoever, but rather predisposition that they might have as to whether they should put the lab report. If there are no further questions.
All right. The court thanks both counsel, and the case is submitted, and we'll stand in recess until 10 of the hour, 9:50. Thank you very much.